Here we are in Salem, Oregon. I'm with Mike Chilton. It's Tuesday.
July 22nd.
And we're here in the evening, and we're beginning tape one, side one. Thank you. Hi, Mike. Well, it's a pleasure being here. And we've talked a little bit, so I can refer back to the tape and say, you know, you mentioned this and that. We always ask a series of background questions. So I guess it's for statistical purposes. We always ask, first of all, when everyone was born. So you were born on?
My day, July 31st, 1937.
And you were born in?
Iowa.
You know, if this was Phil, he would have said in a hospital, you know?
That's
okay.
Right.
You were born in Iowa. What town? I'm sorry.
I was born in Iowa City. My folks were going to school there.
They were going to school there at the time. And your mother and father, what were their occupations when you were young?
My dad was a farmer, mm-hmm. and my mother was a housewife.
Did she also complete a bachelor's degree?
Neither one completed.
Did they work a family farm?
Yeah.
Was it a family farm that had been in the family?
No. It was a family farm not far from my grandfather's place, uh-huh. my mother's father. And that was where we grew up.
And did they have any active church affiliation or activity?
Not really. They were both Christians, but they were not really devout Christians. Not aligned with any one denomination.
And were you active at all in church activities when you were
We went to Bible school when I was in school, when I was grade school. And yes, we went to church on Sunday, usually with my aunts or uncles. And
what church was it?
Just a local Christian church.
Just a Christian church?
A local.
They all have
Christian
names.
Church.
Yes, okay.
And that was
okay.
What it was called.
That's
a
okay.
Christian church.
A Christian
yeah.
church. Oh, good.
Yeah,
okay,
that's
good.
Right.
That's a.
Yeah.
And because it's not the denomination we're interested in, it's
no.
just to be able to differentiate it on a list. Like Lutheran, Episcopal,
no,
Christian.
None of those.
Good.
Yeah.
And was there, I noticed on the form you filled out, you know, we asked, what kind of formative influences might have led you to overseas work or humanitarian service? You mentioned a couple of things,
good
like
question.
Your father or something like that.
Good question.
Yeah.
Probably the most formidable thing
mm-hmm.
was the fact that we grew up on a farm. We were very isolated on the farm. My dad was worldly enough to stimulate our imagination about things beyond the farm fence. Or afford to do anything else, and so this made it interesting. It was a chance. The BS came along. It was a chance to go out and do those things that otherwise had been impossible to do.
Mm-hmm. Did he get books from the library for you about other places or anything like that, or is it?
Oh, we had a lot of books. We had a lot of yeah. books around at home, but. No, mainly it was word of mouth and in the books that he would pull.
Where did you go to high school in?
A little place called Sigourney, southeast Iowa, small school.
Kind of spelt like Sigourney or like
Sigourney,
like,
named
as in
after
Sigourney Weaver. Yeah.
Named after the mid 19th century writer in. What was her first name? Important,
mm-hmm.
but her name was Sigourney,
yeah.
and that town was named after
mm-hmm.
after her. She in fact, has descendants who attended only 2 years ago the sesquicentennial celebration
mm.
of Sigourney, Iowa. Yes, mm. I happened to have the chance to be there.
That's great. Where and why did you choose to go to college?
Well, there again, you know, I think probably I chose to go to Iowa State because I was interested in the agriculture growing up in that kind of an environment. And probably I chose to go to college because it was that opportunity to get away from this very cloistered kind of life that we had by circumstances grown up.
Did you enjoy the agricultural schooling in Iowa?
Well, I started out as an engineer, actually. Uh-huh. Not as an agriculturalist as I thought I might. And only because we thought I would make a good engineer because I had some math aptitude. Only because I think it was probably a conversation that I overheard once that looked like there was a great future. after the first year of taking everything that everybody else took and going into the second year, it became apparent to me that this wasn't an education at all. It was just a preparation for a vocation. And so I got restless and ultimately left. Met up with some of the people in the botany department, and that's where I kind of gravitated to. That kind of became my new home. So I was a botany major in a general science curriculum at Iowa State, which is about as close as that school could offer. Basically aligned myself with the botany department during all my undergraduate.
And how did you hear about IVS?
Well, I think, yeah, I guess, yeah, I guess for the tape here, we'll repeat a bit, but in graduate school, I was within about 4 or 5 months of graduation, up to my ears in a thesis that I found I had to do, but not very exciting, teaching a course on weed identification, of all things. Taking a break one day, this one of the students, realizing I was about to graduate, asked the question, I don't know why he did, what I was going to do after I got out of school. And I didn't have a very good answer. I, in turn, put the question to him, and he said, well, he said, you know, I had a friend in, I had a friend who is a electrical engineer. He's setting up a speech clinic in Laos. Jeez, that's a bit of a disparity between training and what he's done. So I wonder if there'd be an agricultural. Oh, anyway, he gave me the name of the organization, and I went, called over to the library. They gave me an address and a phone number, and I sent a letter to IVS in Washington, D.C., which at that time was headed up by Dr. John Nofsinger, and he sent me back an application. I filled it out, and reasonably long story short, he offered a position to go to Vietnam in about
Did you ever see, meet Dr. Nofsinger?
No, never.
Were you ever interviewed by anyone?
I seriously regret.
And remember, you were never interviewed by anyone from IBS?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
But he had a very interesting system of selecting people that we never knew about at the time, mm-hmm. but he used the second generation of, who did you submit those names? Then he would go back to those people and he'd say, now, who else knows this candidate? Mm-hmm. And he would do this. And I think up to that time there had only been one person that had never really worked out. Everybody else, to one degree or another, had made...
It's interesting that we had no idea about that. We were always amazed that we thought that there was such a need for volunteers that if they were agriculturalists or botanists, someone with a specialty, that they were all automatically accepted just on a need basis. But he did follow up the...
That's my understanding.
The, yeah.
That he used this second generation of references. Uh-huh. And if he had questions, and I know I have a good friend who waited for over a year, and I got the feeling that somewhere along the line, Nofsinger had decided that maybe this guy was a question mark. And so he decided to use this technique of finding out whether the guy was persistent enough. Hmm. And he was, and he finally came after after waiting for well over a year for this opportunity to develop. Yeah.
I'll ask Galen.
Yeah.
I'll ask Galen about the... Galen wouldn't even say the name of the person he worked under because he made very interesting character analysis of Nofsinger, so he didn't want to use his name.
Never met him. I'd love to have met the guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we got a little ahead of ourselves. You got your BA from Iowa State.
A BS,
BS in Iowa State in botany.
From general science with a botany major and a minors in math, physics, and chemistry.
And you went to graduate school at?
Iowa State.
Iowa State,
I continued.
So you continued?
Did a master's degree in economic botany and seed technology. Mm-hmm.
And you were accepted within 6 weeks of applying?
About that, yeah.
And
I finished school. I finished school on, I think I graduated, I don't remember, about the first week in July of that year. It would have been 1960. And I was on my way in about the second week, about 10 days later.
And you knew you were going to Vietnam. Did you have any knowledge of what Vietnam was in 1960?
I went to the library to try to find out something about Vietnam. I found three books. One was The Smaller Dragon by Joseph Buttinger.
Buttinger, yes.
There was a report by the United Nations, I think. And there was something else, probably, I think it was in French, if I'm not mistaken. That was it. 500,000 volumes in Iowa State University's library. And they had three books on Vietnam. That was it. So I knew nothing about it. I left, first time that I'd ever ridden a big plane, from Des Moines. Nofsinger had said that he was going to send me my passport. It never arrived. So just before leaving, I called him and I said, you know, I'm very sorry, but I don't have my passport. Why don't we just go ahead, just send it to me in Hawaii, because I had the ticket already for Hawaii. So I did. And sure enough, it was there when I when I got there. So we had the usual 2 or 3 days of stopover, and moving
Tokyo.
Via Tokyo, we had couple of days in Tokyo. We had 2 or 3 days in Hong Kong, and then to Saigon. I was traveling with George Eason at that time.
No.
George Eason and his wife and young daughter Cindy.
Was it suggested that a stop in Japan and Hong Kong would help acclimatize you to the east?
Oh yes. And when we got to Hong Kong, I had recommendations that I needed to buy a white suit. So I went down to an Indian tailor and I had a white suit made. And this was Nofsinger's suggestion that was the way I should figure to be formally dressed in Southeast Asia. So
what did you generally wear in Southeast Asia when you were?
Light trousers and a light open-throated shirt. That's it.
And
we never wore the white suit. I don't think
never wore it. But that's why you were never invited to the ambassador's parties, quite obviously. Yeah,
probably.
Yes, but the what was your first impression when the door opened when you arrived in Saigon?
Oh God, it was hot. Holding almost. I'd never had anything like it. It was just tremendous heat, and of course we were cramped into that plane. We flew across the Pacific on a prop plane, on a DC-7, long trip, just a refuel at Midway, as I recall, and then to Tokyo. Of course, we came from Tokyo to Hong Kong. Fairly long. We were ready to get off the plane when we arrived in Saigon.
Do you remember who met you?
You
were with George Eason, though.
Nobody met us. They didn't know that we were coming exactly then. We arrived on a Wednesday afternoon, and Wednesday afternoon at that time was a half day off. So that afternoon, and some of the guys were out golfing, but nobody was in the offices. AID was closed on Wednesday afternoon. So we arrived, got downtown. George fortunately had a number of somebody, maybe the number of Brockmuller, I'm not sure.
Gordon
Brockmuller was the chief of party. Anyway, we called and they said, "Oh yeah, we knew you were going to be coming, but we didn't know when." So they met us.
Of course, there was no IBS house in 1960.
No, there was.
There was.
There was.
You didn't know where it was.
It was out near Tanzania. Yeah. It was the headquarters that we used for years subsequently. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
on the livestock experiment station.
And you were there a couple of days, I'd imagine, about 3 days. Before you went off and did something.
How did we do that? Probably. I think we met some of the aid people, and we did all the necessary administrative detail. And then ultimately, we took a trip and visited the various agricultural experiments.
Early days, apparently, it was standard practice to take each new person and take them to each one of the
stations. That's right. That's exactly right. That's what we did.
Did you learn which one you'd be assigned to during the trip or after?
Ah, gee. I think that was pretty much predetermined mm-hmm. by my arrival. Somehow, somebody thought that I was a good horticulturalist. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how that got started. Maybe because I was in botany, because I never had a horticultural course in my life. Because I never had an agricultural course in my life either. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they decided that Delotte should be my would be my station. It was kind of a problem station because of, as I was telling you earlier, the management there, and basically I didn't realize till later, but the station was a multiplication system for landscaping around the city of Delotte under the old colonial times. It really didn't do a great deal of research, if any at all. That's right. So when it was taken over by the Vietnamese, needless to say, they followed, they understood. And we went there thinking that it was a very important research station mm-hmm. where new things were going to be done. And so there was just an automatic conflict in terms of what we conceived of the station and how it was conceived by the host government.
How did that get resolved?
Well, fortunately, there was a fellow from Taiwan who was assigned there about the same time as I. And his name was Chung Sung Yu. And,
well, could you spell that for the tape?
Chung Sung Yu. C-H-U-O-N-G Sung. H-S-I-U-N-G, I believe. And Yu would be Y-U. Chung Sung Yu was with JCRR, Joint Commission on Rural Reconstruction, from Taiwan, an excellent researcher and a very, very knowledgeable man about vegetables.
Yes, people have mentioned him, but no one could remember his name.
Ah!
That's very useful.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I have since met him. Years, mm-hmm. I've been in Taiwan several times in the last 20 years, and I've made a point to look up Chung Sung Yu. He looks exactly as he did in those days. He's very intent, very studious, very straight. I don't think his hair has grayed a bit. The last time I saw him, he helped to set up a company called No New Seed Company, which is one of the outstanding seed companies in Taiwan, even today. And Chung Sung Yu was the research director for years and years. He ultimately then, I think, is retired now. And it's been taken over by, I meet him at some of our international meetings, a fellow by the name of Mr. Chun, and his son, who's also named Chun, I believe. And they have gone on to greater things in the seed world in Taiwan. My point was that mm-hmm. Chung Sung Yu was such a great technician, I decided that this was I'd better follow, tie myself to his shirt tails and learn, and I did, and I watched everything that he did, and so we did, of sorts, make it a research station, and we were working with potatoes, and we were working with a lot of different kinds of vegetables, but onions was another one, and we had some seed from the Desert Seed Company that we had imported through another IVSer that I believe was there for a short time. His name is Don Schmidt, who's now in Portage, Wisconsin. And Don brought this seed in, but he never saw the results of it because he, I think, left possibly. And so I followed on, and we worked with a fellow by the name of Bing. Bing was a farmer, a well-known farmer in the area. I didn't know quite why he was well-known, but I subsequently found out. And Bing grew some wonderful onions, monstrous big onions. And then came to us one day very plaintively saying, I can't sell these onions. What can we do? And he talked and telling me what a pitiful state this was all about. And just before he left my house, this occurred at my house, he said, by the way, order me another 5 kilo of onion seed, if you will.
And you found out he was a very big... The reason why he was so important was because...
He was a member of the local cooperative. And it turned out that he'd done some kind of funny things in the finances with the co-op. And many people knew it. Certainly I didn't, but at that time. But many other people did. And so You know, that was my first lesson in knowing who to work with when you go into a new and a strange mm-hmm. place.
And so his the ultimate, I'm trying to convey to a listener or a reader, the upshot of this dance that he did, which was, oh, I can't sell them to anyone, but please give me 500, you know.
Well, I think he saw the future, and I think he probably was having less of a problem selling than he was letting on. Mm-hmm. That was immortalized in National Geographic on a story on Vietnam in October of 61. And here's Bing's table, mm-hmm. and his bed, and his all of his furniture, all covered with onions, and myself, and by that time another IBSer mm-hmm. by the name of Don Wadley had appeared. And so mm-hmm. we were pictured in that scene that had been taken by National Geographic photographer by the name of Bill Garrett, who ultimately became the editor of National Geographic. So, anyway, this is a kind of a long way to tell how it became an experiment station. But that was a very interesting experience for me because it did teach me how important it was that I should know who I'm working with and the structure. And I also realized then, begrudgingly, that people were not always straightforward as you'd like to think they were. And of course, guys like Bing were classics at being deceptive and somewhat devious. Good farmers, no doubt, good farmers. But very, very clever people indeed. Far
as clever or more clever or the same clever as Yankee farmers in New England.
Oh, probably. I'm not familiar with the Yankee farmers in New England, but... these guys were something. These Vietnamese. What a great experience! I mean, it was just a great experience to learn about a new culture and a system that I would have never been exposed.
Who were you at the station?
Well, there were several people. Dick Peters was there for a short time. Don Schmidt, who's now, as I mentioned, in Wisconsin, was there for a while. Even Neil Spencer. I don't even know. Mm-hmm. It's a familiar name. Neil came up stayed for a short while and some entomological problems. And then ultimately, a guy by the name of Don Wadley came about a year later. And Don was there, and then I left and went home. And I guess I came back, but then I stayed in Saigon and didn't go back to.
Remember what other crops you worked with besides onion?
Oh, yeah. Potatoes was another one. Irish potatoes.
Did either of those take, so to speak? I mean, do you think there's...
Oh, the onions became a big thing. Mm-hmm. But they were hybrid onions, so they couldn't save the seed, you see, and all of these complications that nobody was aware of other than ourselves at those times. The potatoes, I think, were already known, but there was a building American presence in that country. Mm-hmm. So these things had a market that didn't exist before. So, yeah, I think that they did ultimately take. The potatoes, we found that many people weren't too interested in the potatoes because they already knew what they were and they were sold to the French. But as new markets developed, we found the best way to distribute them was to make sure that there was a gate left open or something at night. And of course, these things would get dug up and they'd disappear and they'd suddenly show up in people's gardens and things like that. We actually did that. That was our distribution system. It worked very well. The other thing that happened, about the time, this was still during the days of Zim, and about that time, Zim had visited Dalat, and he had said, you know, this, what was the name of the lake there? Whatever the lake was there in Dalat, it was a lovely lake. And he said, this lake was built by the French and is a nice lake, but the Vietnamese should have their own lake. And so this would be the right place to have it. And it turned out that the station was just above the French lake so that they would put a dike, a barrier across, which turned right through the station mm-hmm. for the Vietnamese lake. Mm-hmm. Well, I came out one morning and they had started to dig the trench. That's the way things happen when Zim said that they should happen. And so from then on, all practical purposes, activities at the station were rapidly fading away. And what am I going to do? You know, and one of the things that I realized that there was really a need for one of the serious pests in that area was slugs. And by good fortune, I had observed a technician up from Saigon who had used a bit of what's called metaldehyde. It's a very basic slug bait. And he mixed a 1% mix of metaldehyde with rice bran.
And rice?
Rice bran.
Right.
Bran. Mm-hmm. Just the coverings of the rice. Mm-hmm. And mix this up. And then he'd take a handful and he'd put it down on the beds between the cabbage plants and break off a lower leaf in the cabbage and cover it. And go out the next morning and there'd be, literally 100 slugs that had been attracted to that overnight.
Mm-hmm. Dead.
So I remembered that. And it was so dramatic. And so I started doing this with a few growers, and it really did endear me for things to come. I was amazed. It wasn't my original idea or anything, but it was an opportunity to do something for the community that they wanted to do, but that they needed, I should say. And it worked. It was very, very dramatic. So it taught me also that you didn't need to do big things, but what you needed to do had to be very, very effective. And that was just serendipitous example of a situation that came my way. So yeah, it was very helpful.
Would you say that, you know, getting to the root of that particular example, was this a Vietnamese expert who came up, or a U.S. AID?
This fellow, I believe it was a combined team. And a young fellow, let's see if I can think of his name, Los Banos graduate from the Philippines, I believe. I think his name was Quinn. And he came up with one of the aid people, and they brought along this metaldehyde material.
Mm-hmm. So essentially what happened was that USAID was experimenting, had its own little experimentation, who observed it and said, you know, this might be an effective thing through the research station, and it turned out to be very successful. Mm-hmm. Could you trace how farmers were using that? Was there a...
Well, the problem, of course, was always getting this metaldehyde, because mm-hmm. that was something that had to be imported. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether the co-op ultimately imported slug bait, mm-hmm. or I just really don't know.
But you had an impression that it was very successful.
I'm sure that if it was, mm-hmm. if its continuation was based upon the demand from the farmers, it would have spread all over the entire vegetable growing area. Mm-hmm. Slugs was a serious problem. They liked to keep their ground acidic, and the only solution they had to slug control at that time was they would use a kind of a slurry, a lime slurry, and put it on the ground, and that would kill the slugs when they came in contact with it. Mm-hmm. But they didn't like to use it because it tended to sweeten up the ground. I could never figure it out, but that was the way the farmers spoke. Mm-hmm. So metaldehyde was a good option, alternative option. Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's one of the most detailed discussions we've had of an actual crop, an actual thing introduction, because a lot of us, we tried this. The onion thing came up.
Yeah.
It was considered very successful by everyone. They tried grapes around Phang Rang.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be very successful, too.
Is that, yeah.
And IVS may be responsible for any grape growth.
I don't know of that, not during my time, because there were a few grapes there by the French who had grapes or grapes growing up in the Tron area. Mm-hmm.
And so you spent about how long at the Delonce Station?
I spent about a year, And then I went to Saigon the second year as a team leader for the agricultural team.
Did you have any R&R in that period?
We flew over to Cambodia, and George and his team was there, and a couple of those guys joined us, and we went up to Angkor Wat. And so Angkor Wat. That was one, and then I think after the first year I took an R&R. Bill Barlow, whose name I gave you earlier, was going to go with me, and something happened, and he wasn't able to do it. I went to Cambodia. I went to meet him. He wasn't going to be able to make the trip, so I said, well, the hell, I'll do it myself. And so I got on a train, went up to Bangkok, stayed overnight at the border, spent some time in Bangkok, took a train to Penang, which was about a day or day and a half trip, as I recall. Spent some time in Penang, then to Kuala Lumpur, then to Singapore. This is a month-long vacation. And I think I had, they gave me $300, I believe. And I flew to Jakarta. Took a train across the island of Java, ultimately ending up in Bali. Spent a few days in Bali, met some Indonesian students there who took me around, and I, traveling by myself, turned out to be a great opportunity that I had not anticipated. I was by myself, where had I been with someone else, it would have not been near the same. Approachable individually, it would not have been.
Agricultural station after your first year?
Well, I went to Saigon. I was asked to come down to Saigon as a team leader for a program that was just beginning, and it was in the agricultural development of the tribes and tribal areas. And so that was very interesting. We ultimately set up what we called a research and development agricultural center in each of about 8 or 10 provinces, if I'm not mistaken. And we had one or more volunteers at each one of these stations. And I was an expediter. I got involved in personnel. I got involved in budgetary issues. I got involved in program issues that was helping to bring these centers into being. And they were basically carved out of areas that were available to the tribal people, and we tried to have local teachers as possible, IVSers in some cases, but more likely sympathetic Vietnamese, Montagnard who had been trained, and teach them basic agriculture. And we had a couple of little livestock projects in which we had goats or we had pigs that would be traded, be made available to the tribesmen, and then as they multiplied, well, then that an animal came back and was re-given out to someone else, and so we had a perpetuating kind of a program.
Look at that, these folk had been living there for a long time. Did they need this assistance, or why?
Well, that's a good question. Of course, we always thought they did, and one of the reasons that I guess you'd have to say that they did was because they were being rapidly resettled at that time, because the insurgency had already begun. And many of these tribes people had been brought out of back areas where they had lived for generations and been brought up along roads, and they were in cramped conditions, and there were sanitation problems, and there were new survival problems that they had never had to encounter before. So that was the purpose of the gardens and the fruit trees and the little livestock projects, and there were home sanitation, probably good drinking water, for example, and that kind of thing, that really in their natural environment were not really issues because it was already there. But
that maybe opens an interesting social and cultural issue, which it was moving these people out of their natural environment.
Oh, it was very unpopular.
Kind of
very
settlement.
Yeah. Very, very unpopular. Yeah. It was,
thinking back on it, and we're talking about in retrospect, not what, actually I'd like to look at it both ways. At the time, obviously these people had a problem, and IVS was trying to help them with a problem at hand.
You see, and the issue was that the Vietnamese government did not really address Montagnard issues. for political purposes, there was a Ministry of Montagnard Affairs. Mm-hmm. But these people were very aloof, and they were more involved in the politics of the Vietnamese system than mm-hmm. they were in actually helping their own people. Mm-hmm. So they were only modestly of help, I would say. There was no other agency in the government that was of interest. Mm-hmm. Occasionally you got province chiefs that were interested, and some of them gave a lot of support to these programs. But we had to derive some of our, a good bit of our early support from private sources. And interestingly, I mean, that's how I happened to meet my wife, as a matter of fact.
How was that?
I was looking for financial support through Asia Foundation, and she was working at Asia Foundation.
Right.
I got the support.
And a wife.
And a wife.
When did you get married?
In 69.
In 69, so this is
69. So this is quite
after.
A bit earlier.
Right. Uh-huh.
This is quite a bit earlier. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Actually, I'm interested in a particular issue, so let's forget this interview for a moment. No, I'm interested. There's always been a Highlander-Lowlander conflict.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout Southeast Asia.
Oh, yeah.
And interestingly enough, when Zap was setting up the Viet Minh, the first people he went to were Highlander people, because they were distant from the French, and, you know, it was a different track, actually. So it's odd that the Viet Minh started in the mountains first rather than in the plains, which I think is interesting. The Diem regime had a different view of Montagnard territories. These were areas that could be exploited perhaps for resettlement of Catholics. Or
oh, sure.
Exactly, and they had a kind of...
which tended to push them aside without much concern or sensitivity about their well-being.
And but the United States had a different view of the Montagnards, because they could represent a viable force against... Yes, thank you for saying that, because I see then I didn't lead you to it. I led you to it, but you said it. No, because I'm curious, this is what I find in my research, that it would be useful. So what happened was there was an interesting push and pull, whereas Diem would have preferred to use that territory and those people for his purposes, but if it would please the Americans, if they wanted to go and do this, it wasn't such a big issue that he wouldn't give way. But he wouldn't have a creative Montagnard policy.
No.
Reaching out to the Montagnards and saying, no, let's all fight the communists.
The Vietnamese were very insular mm-hmm. about their approach towards the Montagnard, and there was a great deal of antagonism, and there were serious abuses mm-hmm. that always kept a big void between the Montagnards and the Vietnamese.
Did you ever work with American... that was one of the areas the Green Beret was most active in the 60s.
Oh, sure, we knew a lot of the mm-hmm. Green Beret operations and mm-hmm. the A-teams and the mm-hmm. and the B-teams there. And sure, in fact, I don't know, did you ever run across Tracy Atwood?
No.
Tracy was at the Green Beret camp. In fact, our Montagnard Training Center was right adjacent to mm-hmm. the Green Beret camp in Quang Duc Province. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the town that it was in?
It was outside of Giang Ia, when Giang Ia was the provincial headquarters of that.
Could you spell that for the team?
Giang Ia. Yeah. G-I-A-N-G-H-I-A, I believe. Yeah.
You want to take
right.
something? I can turn
that's
this off.
That's all right. That's okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
That's a fact.
That's okay.
Right.
Go ahead.
Okay. You know, that's fascinating, because I don't think that story has been told. I mean, fortunately, there's an American expert on those affairs, Gerald Cannon Hickey.
So Jerry, I used to travel with Jerry Hickey,
exactly.
Yes.
So tell me about your travels with Jerry Hickey. And
well, geez, I don't know. Jerry was with USIA, USIS, I believe, at the time. And Jerry had established himself as a kind of an authority at the Montagnard. Jerry was a very academic type of a person, I would say, and he was very unobtrusive, very quiet. He spoke intelligently about the issues of the tribes people, and of course very few people knew anything about it. But Jerry had become a student of the tribal people, and knew a good bit about it. He knew a lot of their ethnicities,
the ethnographic.
That's right.
Experience.
That's right. And the relationships between the different tribes, and of course, he was quite close to some of the missionaries who were very active in the tribal areas, which was a great source of information to him.
Any interesting stories about adoption ceremonies or anything like that? But IBS or...
Oh, gee, I...
A lot of drinking up there, you know.
There was always a... There was always a ceremony. It took very little to provoke a ceremony in a Rade or a Jirai village or any of the other villages, which was usually focused on the rice wines. I can't think of anything right off.
I was just studying an advisor who was like adopted by about 30 tribes, and he was fascinated.
Well, I've always heard this, you know. Of course, I get some of this from guys like... Mike Binge, too, but I think it's kind of like some of these stories are kind of like whiskey. It gets a little better with age.
Uh-huh. We're just trying to find some color here wherever we can. Not dirt, color, that's all. And,
I was always a little suspect.
Yeah.
Although, I don't want to belittle those who really identify with the Mountain Yard and were very, very important to their...
But at that time, you saw yourself essentially as an administrator setting up these programs.
I'm afraid that's probably right. That's true. And that's what I was, a kind of an expediter to help and try to see this thing through. We ultimately did get the attention of the Ministry of Education, I believe. And supposedly, these training centers were ultimately taken over through some kind of budgetary arrangements through the Ministry of Education.
Interesting. I have to go back to people like John Llewellyn and others who... actually were at those stations as later on as the war.
There were people, there were Americans who found these ideas very interesting, and they would give in kind or they'd give cash, and the Asia Foundation was very forthcoming on support for these kind of things, and we had church groups that would give things that some of the members had been able to secure from their home contacts, things like that. So it was really kind of a catch-as-catch-can initially, but it did ultimately develop some momentum that always would love to know what happened to them. I never knew. But,
so you spent a year coordinating this?
I spent the second year of my first tour with IVS. And then I came back and continued in more or less the same position in a second tour with IVS.
Well, before we get ahead of ourselves, your first tour, 2 years, came to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And then what did you do?
Well, it was about the time that Dave Nuttall, who was also involved in the tribal areas and in a kind of a transitional way.
Transitional meaning?
Well, from IVS to some kind of a relationship through the clandestine operations. And I could only speculate what that might have been, but there again, Dave had the very, he had the capability to elaborate a great deal on these kind of things. And so, of course, Dave kept everybody guessing.
Yes.
Dave and I traveled back to the States together. In those days, IVS gave us a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And that ticket involved so many miles from Saigon back to wherever you're going back in the States. Then we would take it down. It was quite legal at that time to take it down, rewrite it through some... transfer through some travel agency, and set up our schedule. And so we had about 20 stops in a 60-day trip.
You and Dave Nuttall.
Dave and I. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Starting out with Bangkok and then going to India and Afghanistan and, holy balls, Iran. And
so this would have been in
1962.
The summer
October to... December of 1962.
That's a great time to go to India and Afghanistan.
It was a great experience.
Taj Mahal?
We went. Oh sure, saw the Taj Mahal, at night as well as daytime and moonlight.
In the winter.
Moonlight. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Wonderful. Went down to Jaipur.
Mm-hmm.
To the Pink City. Yeah. Oh yeah. It was just absolutely great. We went to. Kabul, were there for a few days. We stopped at Amritsar.
It was in all those places my first time in 1974.
Years later. In Kabul in those days, the Russians and the Americans were competing.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of Aleutians, what was the plane, Aleutian 11, Aleutian 14 or something, coming in, bringing in supplies. Americans were there.
And world building contests.
Had a big aid contingent there.
Mm-hmm.
There was a, let me see if I can remember.
I remember this, how was it? This, it was a kind of a canteen or a big kind of a buffet feeding area, restaurant of sorts. The building had been built by the Russians. It had been equipped by the Americans, something like that. I'm not sure that it was the right order, but, you know, it was amazing. We then went to, Tehran, we went to Jordan.
Petra? Petra?
Where?
Petra?
No.
The city of stone?
No, okay. Did not. No, we were in Amman. Mm-hmm. Went across the border into Israel. What was that? Oh, we must have gone to, oh, that's right, from... We were in, I'm getting ahead of myself here. We flew from Kabul, went to Tehran, then to Syria, no, then to Iraq, then to Syria, then to Cairo, each, you know, over to the Sphinx, and saw all of the sites, the museum in Cairo, and all of these things, Hanging Gardens of Amun Iran, I believe, and ultimately crossed over through the Mendenbaum Gate and into Israel. And then, in order to get back into the Middle East, we flew to all these places.
Cyprus.
Flew to Cyprus, and then back to Beirut. Spent some time in Beirut. Went up to Tripoli and up to the Cedars of Lebanon, and spent a few days in Beirut. Then to Ankara. Opal, over to Athens. Oh, great trip, absolutely great trip. And doing all of this on almost nothing. We were staying in cheap little hotels and just eating in restaurants where we had no idea what we were going to get. We would just point on the menu to things to order that would come, and we'd eat whatever came. And, we traveled with, we bought... otterskin caps in India. So each of us had one. David, by that time, had a beard. I was clean-shaven in those days. And we came around a corner in Rome, I remember, and somebody spotted us and thought we were Russians. And, oh, we were embraced, and we were so... It was so wonderful, you know. And all of this we kind of had to surmise because of things that were said in the Italian language, of which we understood almost nothing. But it was the cap that was the giveaway. And somehow he thought that was Russian. It was so funny. Another place in Athens, these caps, they knew we were Russians, and the guys remembered the things that had happened during the
Civil War,
and we damn near got ran out of a bus station by an old man who was just that rate. Until we finally admitted, no, we're Americanos. Funny. Anyway, we completed that trip by going from Rome over to Spain. Gee, what was the town? The first town. It was in harbor, in Replica. Mm-hmm. Down to Mallorca, back through the southern cities there of Seville and Cordoba, and finally over to Lisbon and to New York. To New York, we'd have a big steak in New York, and just got sicker than hell. We couldn't.
I know it's traditional. I've done it. I did that in the El Paso thing.
Yeah.
Being in Yucatan for a month.
Everyone did that.
I didn't get sick, but the people I was with were. Certainly bloated, no question.
Met a couple of young kids on a street in New York who were very Puerto Rican looking, and we didn't really like the name of looks of them particularly, and so. We spoke to each other in Vietnamese, and it completely deflated them. They said, "Well, don't you speak English?" And we gave them some more Vietnamese, and away they went. But we didn't know quite what was going to happen there. We could only surmise. So
actually, that's a pretty good question. How did you get Vietnamese training? Within the first month when you arrived?
Yeah, that was the only Vietnamese training that we had.
What did you get?
We had about. I don't remember, probably 4 hours or so a day that we were expected to sit down and learn Vietnamese with an interpreter.
And your interpreter was?
The interpreter, a couple of interpreters. One who's no longer around. His brother is in this country now. This guy was, his name was Quy, Nguyen Van Quy.
Could you spell that for the...
Quy, Nguyen Van Quy, Q-U-Y. And he had a younger brother who's now Bao. Bao was, I believe, the last I heard in Connecticut. Okay, his health was not too good. Wonderful guy. There was a Chi, Bui Zung Chi. Mm-hmm. Bui Zung Chi taught me some Vietnamese. Because I was learning Northern Vietnamese all this time, mm-hmm. because these are all Northern guys. Mm-hmm. Little did I know, or I even considered to be very important then, but I was always spotted as having little bit of a northern accent instead of a southern accent.
Where did you stay when you were getting this tutorial?
Well, this was at the house in the lot. Mm-hmm. This is where I was going to work, mm-hmm. and so these boys came up and they stayed right there in the house.
You were paid by IPS to do that.
Yep, yeah. Yep, that's right. They stayed there. They ate with us and so on.
Now we get to the fun part. You're in New York. You after this wonderful vacation, which. I replicated as closely as I could, by the way, in 1973-74. And then, and it really was. You could stay at a hotel for 50 cents a night in those days. It's remarkable. But then what did you do after you left New York?
We went down to Washington, D.C., as I recall. I don't know how. We must have flown. I suppose we flew down. And I checked in with IBS. By that time, Nofsinger was gone. Now, would he have died? He might have died, mm-hmm. probably. Mm-hmm. And Russ Stevenson was the director, if I'm not mistaken. Wonderful guy. Great guy. We don't hear much of Russ anymore. But the last I heard, he was on a farm in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Probably fairly elderly now. Mm-hmm. I saw him at a reunion a good many years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, I suppose. But Russ had become the executive director. He had been a professor, I believe, at the American University in Cairo. I think he had done some work in Cairo. Hockmuller worked under him when he came back to the offices in Washington. Ultimately, he was replaced. I don't remember when he resigned or other things. I don't mm-hmm. know what happened.
But you checked into the IBS office.
Yeah. Did whatever I thought was appropriate. I don't have a very clear recollection of it. Spent a day or two there, and then went home, back to Iowa. Probably one of the biggest disappointments of my life. You know, it wasn't what it was when I left.
What did it become?
Well, it was a foreign country. Uh-huh. It had become a foreign country. Nobody was particularly interested in the things that I thought should be important. It was a long 6 weeks.
And how did it come to an end?
Well, I went back to Vietnam.
Well, but how did that happen? How did that come about?
Oh, I had decided already that I was going to go back to Vietnam because this had been such a great experience that I decided that 2 years was just the beginning. It wasn't the end. And so I went back as a team leader. I was invited to come back as a team leader. I'd done all this before I left Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. We're on your on that form we had you fill out, or ask you. That at graduate school or something, professors told you that it was a waste of time.
Oh, yeah. I was really disappointed there. I got no particular support at all. In fact, it was a wonder that I ever did this. Because one guy, my major professor, had decided that I should probably use my study in seed technology. Mm-hmm. Could use it best by becoming a manager of a seed laboratory somewhere out in Idaho, which just seemed like way out there on the west,
yes.
Long ways away.
Yeah,
and the last thing in the world I intended to do was to continue doing the thing that I'd almost lost my eyesight on, doing this thesis work. I wasn't very impressed by his offer, but I didn't dare tell him that. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I'd quietly gone about finding out about this IBS experience. And so ultimately it materialized, and he told me, Mike, he said, my goodness, he said, you're going to lose your seniority. I said, God, how many do I have? And anyway, without hurting him, or at least hopefully without hurting him, I chose the path that I had created for myself.
So you decided to go back as a team leader.
Yeah.
And what were your duties as a team leader?
Well, let's see. I guess that could be simply said in continuation of what I've been doing that second year of my first tour.
Mm-hmm.
This was an expanded activity in the Montagnard Development Training Centers. In the meantime, the IVS team had accepted new responsibilities for a malaria control
mm-hmm.
team also. And I was the team leader for that group also.
There you go. How did the project start? This is from, I'd imagine, when did you go back?
Must have gone back in January of 63, I suppose.
So by the time you went back to Vietnam, Diem had been assassinated.
He's been assassinated
in
before
November.
I left.
Before you left?
No, that's
no,
right. He was assassinated in November of 63,
mm-hmm.
so that would have been during my second tour. He was still there when I went back.
He was still there when you went back. So it was October of 62 that
I left.
That you left, right.
Right.
And then you came back
in January of 63.
63. Okay.
Right. Right.
And you started out on these projects and
that's right. It was full time. It was very busy. Did a lot of traveling up country, coordinating, working as a liaison program expediter for this project. In a role with AID because there was new interest in AID to help this program along. And the war was starting to heat up.
Yeah.
You bet.
Yeah. Exactly. How did that feel? Would you have any reflections on that? Now, you know, you've been
well,
in Vietnam
in those
for
days,
a couple of years.
In those days, you know, we had never had to think about where we were going to work. It just seemed like we worked where it was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw a lot of opportunities. It was interesting in those days because we had no command control of anything. We had all the responsibility that we could accept, but we had not one bit of authority to see anything through.
Mm-hmm.
We had to develop our own ways to establish or to get things done. And basically it was by persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done, had to be done on the basis of something that was interesting to the Vietnamese, and hopefully to the Americans too. And of course, we tried to keep the Americans going. In hindsight, it was great. It was great training ground because, you know, unlike any other American structure there, there was no command system or anything like that. It was basically done by persuasion.
To be an example of that kind of work.
The development of the training centers,
mm-hmm.
for example. You worked with people who tended to identify or to associate with what was important. It might have been a province chief, it might have been a local school teacher, it might have been a village chief, it might have been an enlightened young Montagnard, and you worked, every place you worked a little bit differently. Hopefully the Vietnamese government would become a part, be interested, but you couldn't depend upon it.
And you had the Asia Pacific.
That's right. Yeah.
How closely did you work with USAID in those days? Besides,
oh, very
they
close.
Had all the seed. And
very
all the
close.
Stuff.
Very close. Yeah, they were a material support element.
We had
very
good liaison. Oh, do you remember who your liaison was with USAID?
Mm-hmm. In the early years, it was a fellow by the name of Howard Harper.
Mm-hmm.
Howard Harper. Ultimately finished his tour there, which I think was at least two tours in Vietnam. He was very good. He was very understanding of IVS and all the complexities, and he and Brock Miller went back, Harper left. Don Luce came back then as the chief of party,
mm-hmm.
and a guy by the name of Les Britton
mm-hmm.
became the contract representative to it. Les was perhaps less understanding. He was well-intending, but he didn't have quite the... Moreover, it was becoming more complex because aid was becoming deeper and deeper involved, too. But yes, we generally had a very close working relationship.
Hmm.
It was a good
relationship. But let's move a little bit forward. When you're working on these projects, you get there in January, you're still there in November when Diem is assassinated. And supposedly after Diem was assassinated, there was a lot of the dieback of development, duration of the situation, especially since the government seemed to rise and, you know.
Well, the local structure deteriorated in many ways. I can think of one example. The Forest Service under Zim had been a very hierarchical system that really protected the forest very, very carefully when Zim was there. And after Zim was gone, that began to erode. And ultimately, tracks started to open up. A lot of the forest was cut for the money that was involved. And there were army officers that were involved, and on and on and on, you know. But that whole system deteriorated. So, yeah, I would say that would be one example of the transition. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In response to that deterioration, the U.S. government began stepping up its aid to the South. Things seemed to be getting more critical.
Yeah, it was somewhere along there that the aid definitely started to ratchet upwards, and they were very dissatisfied with the way that aid was being funneled down through the various functions of the national government, mm-hmm. through the provincial government. And so aid became involved in the Office of Field Provincial Operations or something like that. They had provincial offices. They started, I think they had their first one up in the Fujian province. A guy by the name of Bob Burns was the first aid operator there, a very interesting kind of a guy with Laos experience. An IVSer up there by the name of Bob McNiff.
Okay.
Bob and Bob worked together in the first experiment. And then it ultimately spread. And then our contacts became very close to the USAID provincial representative. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, they were in every province. I mean, there was a guy in Quinyon. There was an officer by the name of Lawrence, who's now in outside of Kansas City, Missouri, by the name of John Whitmer. There was a guy by the name of Dale LaCour that was also up there for a while. Kierstead ultimately worked for malaria.
Right.
Out of Quinyon, after he had married and moved up there with AID. And each province had its provincial rep and had IVS representatives. So IVSers turned more to the prop rep for their support, because aid was funneling in large amounts
directly
of money
to the province. So
directly to the province.
Actually, the